picture iconic images of Trayvon Martin, Serena Williams, LeBron James, Diana Ross, and Barack Obama. Consider representations of black families on TV shows. Google black and see what phrases come up along with it. My three guests today share an interest in the topic of seeing blackness. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Joining me is Herman Gray, professor and chair of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He specializes in black visual cultures, jazz, and media representations, as in his book Watching Race, Television and the Struggle for Blackness. Nicole Fleetwood is the director of the Institute for Research on Women and a professor of American Studies at Rutgers University, specializing in visual culture, media studies, black cultural studies, and gender theory. She's the author of Troubling Vision, Performance, Visuality, and Blackness, and also On Racial Icons, Blackness and the Public Imagination, and she's also interested in art in prison. Also joining us in the studio is Jay Ketelansky, UW-Madison MFA student and practicing artist whose work plays with images of blackness and how they shift the narrative. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have this topic, but it's also challenging for radio because we're talking about images. On the other hand, sometimes I've found that radio is actually the ideal medium to talk about images because it forces us to think about what comes into our mind, how we already have certain images that we associate with things. I was going to ask each of you to talk about how you got into this topic and what in particular that phrase, seeing blackness, means. Let me start with you, Herman.
That's a good question. I think I got into it because I was interested in industrial production. Like, how do you make television shows? And from there, I think I wanted to understand how people who create images translate their production practices into ideas that ultimately appear on the screen. And it was a real political interest. Like, how do you unhook the history of black abjection and exaggeration from the production process? How do you create new kinds of images? And is there something embedded in how people create things?
So when you say production, you mean just like
I mean writers,
a show,
writers'
producers.
Rooms, yeah, producers and directors and camera angles and sound. I mean the whole way in which you put a television text together. So in my work on television, one of the things that I was always after was to try to understand how that happened and how black folks were constructed, represented, shown in television. And the possibilities for showing and telling different kinds of stories. So I came at it through an interest in the industry itself.
And if you look back at the history of the industry, at the representation of blacks on television, what's most important for us to remember?
The persistence of, I think, the ways in which blackness, and I'm separating black people from blackness. Blackness as an idea sticks to black bodies. How it sticks to the idea that this body is the embodiment of some idea of black people, right? And so I think it's important to understand the ways in which television, cinema, and kind of dominant forms of representation reiterate that story. And at the same time, how black artists and black musicians and poets and writers are also working to tell a different kind of story and the ways in which those particular kinds of stories find their way into a public imagination. So that's why I use the language of struggle and contestation to talk about the ways in which these counter forces are always at play in the production of an image culture in which black people are the subjects of those representations.
Can you give me a really specific, concrete example?
I'll take one from my book on television. The reason I called it Television and the Sign of Blackness, or the Struggle for Blackness, was I wanted to emphasize the way in which during the Reagan administration, the Republican Party used the idea of black dependency to organize white loyalty to the Republican Party. And at the same time, African-American writers and artists and painters and filmmakers were struggling to bring different kinds of black images to the screen. Right. So if one thinks about the television shows of the 80s and 90s in American network television, I wanted to underscore this tug of war over destabilizing what was a historical inheritance of the black image. And that's why the struggle, I think television is a theater of struggle in which one sees that. And I think that's true today. So I think there are lots of examples that one can point to where one sees the kind of tug of war over what it might mean to be black that often has very little to do with African-American people.
And Nicole, let me turn to you. You have several books out that have to do with vision and blackness or racial icons. Tell me about what brought you to this topic and, again, what that phrase, seeing blackness, might mean.
And I should say that, you know, listening to Herman, my work is definitely influenced by his work and the work of other scholars in the field. We were talking recently about how this is really a collaboration. The scholarship is a collaboration. It's not really single author work that we are sharing ideas, that these ideas are growing together. And so definitely the forces of mass media and television hover above much of the work I do. But I am also interested in what might seem more like the quotidian kind of everydayness of experience that we don't think of as mediated, and yet and still it is mediated. So when we think about how we interact with people on the streets, how we walk by someone, how we literally perceive race and gender in ways that we're not even consciously recognizing as our kind of making decisions and discriminating, discerning, and also making all kinds of value judgments based on the kind of really subtle discernments that we're making around how close we get to someone when we're standing in public, where we decide to sit, where we decide to eat. And, you know, even bigger issues in terms of where we decide to live and who we decide to love. I'm really interested in the relationship between the kind of everydayness of that and these larger iconic representations of blackness through the figurations of black subjects, as Herman was saying. And so my recent book on racial icons is really a conversation between the kind of everydayness of living in this moment, this 21st century, kind of early 21st century, and the, you know, massive production of images of blackness that hover between what I say is a kind of veneration and denigration. So kind of worshiping and a constant kind of dehumanizing that takes place in figurations of Obama, for example. And also, in, you know, kind of tragic figurations of racial violence, like a Trayvon Martin, who's now this venerated subject. But his life was taken because of his, you know, the absolute disregard for his embodiment, you know, his life. So I'm interested in that, the kind of conflict and tensions there between this kind of worshiping and this hatred.
I noticed that you also have written on the, well, you've got things about sports icons, on sort of the celebrity icon, but your first chapter in the book on racial icons is on Trayvon Martin, and you call it "I Am Trayvon Martin." Are you referring in terms of the image of the sort of the hoodie?
So the "I Am Trayvon Martin" chapter is looking at the viral campaign. And the kind of taking up Trayvon Martin by many millions of protesters who, you know, donned a hood and actually, you know, took their own self-portrait, and looking at how that kind of connection to his, you know, this kind of racial violence and suffering, it's not only taken up by African Americans, but by people globally. You know, the kind of shift, the 21st century shift that we might see in terms of perhaps a new social movement around racial suffering and racial violence, but also the real tricky kind of claiming or standing in the shoes of, that is always a problematic way of kind of relating to otherness, to difference, to suffering. So I look at it with, hopefully, with a sympathetic eye, but I'm also cautious about some of that, you know, that kind of substitution that takes place in the "I Am Trayvon Martin" campaigns.
You mean that if you sort of take this approach, I am Trayvon Martin and mm-hmm. Donna Hood, that are you in a sense overstepping? Are you claiming something that can't be claimed?
Exactly. Are you claiming something that can't be claimed? I mean, the fact is that Trayvon's parents will never have Trayvon back. I mean that right. that's the brutal fact of it.
And then
that I am not Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. you know, and that void that was left by when his life was taken is still felt by everyone who knew him.
And that one picture, a picture with a mm-hmm. hood, can't define a person either.
I think that is exactly what people are trying to problematize by saying I am Trayvon Martin, that what was seen as this image of suspicion by many in dominant media, many who, you know, don't identify as racist, but who still are definitely operating with a racial kind of binary where black is bad and white is good, see somebody as suspect. And I think that people who took up the I Am Trayvon Martin campaign were really trying to problematize that by coming close to that which other people find suspicious and actually kind of, you know, donning that.
Just to add to Nicole's point, I think because America has a history of this veneration and denigration, and black people experience this history on the body and in memory, then it's a very delicate balance. It's a very delicate dance to then make the substitution in a way that erases the very subjectivity that's being identified with, right? That we want to be careful that we develop modes of empathy and modes of identification that are collaborative, that are not replacement modes, right? And so I think to call up these campaigns for their critical possibilities as well as the ways in which they literally kind of reproduce the very objection that the book is about is part of the trick in this. And I think this applies to so much of the image culture where the image of black people globally now saturate the image culture. And it's, I think, an opportune moment to pause and to sort of take the measure of the sort that Nicole's doing to try to get us to pay attention to that very delicate balance. And in that sense, these are as much projects of social imagination and social movements and working together as they are symbolic images that are simply, you know, a kind of substitute for a deeper way of thinking about who we are and how we live together and the modes of connection to each other.
I suppose anytime you have symbols, there's a danger of simplifying something to one icon, one image, rather than the complexity, the nuances mm-hmm. of it. Jay, let me ask you, I know we're going to talk about your art later, but what brought you to this notion, you know, participating in kind of a conversation on seeing blackness? You are a MFA student working on your own art. How does this topic kind of affect your own work?
Well, I would say that I got to this point when I was an undergrad and I was in an African-American literature class. I mean, it's focused on Native American literature for a few weeks, Asian American literature for a few weeks, and then African American literature for a few weeks. And the professor had asked the class if they ever heard who Emmett Till was. And this is college level class. This were in our third year of undergrad. And no one knew who Emmett Till was. And at that moment, I knew that I was alone. And it was the same time that Trayvon Martin was recently killed. And so I realized that, you know, I needed to make this work because no one else was discussing it within this art community that I was a part of. And I was also not seeing myself in art history that we were learning about. I didn't see myself in any of the examples that my professors were bringing up in class. And I just decided that, you know, this was it. This is what I needed to do.
In your own art that you're creating, are you sort of working or playing with images as well?
Yeah, so I work right now. I'm working on work based off of a mythical being that I use as a way to talk about the dehumanization of blackness, and I call them Phantom Negro for long, Phantom for short.
So phantom in terms of shadows from the past, things that we're haunted by. Phantom in what sense?
Phantom is, you know, time traveling, shape shifting, gender shifting, of being that exists now and exists in the past and exists in the future. And it's a way that I can, you know, discuss about what things are going on in the world, such as, you know, the Trayvon Martin or Eric Garner, but it gives me some leeway to control the narrative in some sense, so I don't feel so helpless in what's going on in the world.
I see. And let me ask you this, back to you, Herman. Your book on TV images of blackness goes further back in the past. And can you talk a little bit about the role of the Amos and Andy show and some of the early representations? What became sort of problematic in terms of visually representing or even in terms of speech?
Well, I mean, I think the Amos and Andy example is rich and fraught both at the same time, since, you know, its initial emergence was the brain trust of two white guys on radio who were imitating African Americans. And by the time it found its way to television, and one has to think also about the state of television at the time, network television certainly, when they sort of acquired black actors and put the words and the writing and all that stuff together, I think Amos and Andy was exactly the kind of fraught object, precisely because it was caught in this kind of white imagination about who black folks were, black actors needing work, and a certain modicum of kind of black insider humor. And so some people loved it and some people hated it. But I think the important thing was that it was disputed, right? Not that it was a uniformly, it was a site of dispute, right? A site of black making, right? And in that sense, I think the medium itself is the reason I call it a theater, that we literally saw before our eyes this kind of dispute being played out. So the NAACP didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. They brought a suit, right?
Right, and parts of the black working class community liked it, right? So how do we reconcile this uneasy juxtaposition of these two positions? And I think that so much of the history of the image of black folks in dominant media has been framed within that kind of framework. And so what I think, again, to return to this theme, it's important that African Americans be involved in the sort of conversation about what the image culture looks like, and that that conversation involves a multiplicity of positions. There is no one, as Nicole would say, iconic position that freezes who black people are, right? And so the way in which the logics of television, the logics of cinema, the production, the economic pursuit of profit narrows the range of conversations is, I think, part of why Amos and Andy became this kind of lightning rod, right?
Can I chime in? And just to piggyback off of what Herman's saying, and these conversations don't go away. I mean, we can think about just even current conversations around Tyler Perry,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, they're very reminiscent of Amos and Andy debates, right? Mm-hmm. And also in terms of who supports Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry is very, very popular, and, you know, his what he puts out makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that those of us who are critical of, and I don't mean critical as in good, bad, but who have a kind of critique of representational politics and practices, we also can't in any way be instrumental in trying to, quote, clean up images, right?
Right,
like
right.
That there's, yeah, you know, we're not looking for some kind of spotless image of blackness,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that this is all very messy terrain. And I think what makes it really interesting and productive is that we have different constituents at the table, you know, whatever that, you know, metaphoric or discursive table is, talking about their kind of own investments or what Jonathan Gray was saying, their dislike, you know, that also registering something that's bothersome is also important. And I think that we're in a kind of culture of agreement, and that when people disagree with something, that they're often kind of shunned mm-hmm. or marginalized in the conversation. And especially when we're talking about issues around race and racial politics, right? That mm-hmm. we have a space where we can actively have kind of disagreement, right? And have different investments mm-hmm. in, mm-hmm. you know, a motley, an assortment of images.
Mm-hmm. So what would be some of the problems with the Tyler Perry massive, sort of almost like an empire, really, I mean, production of lots of films, lots of characters and images, looking at it from the vantage point of your work?
I think the popular way in which Tyler Perry both circulates and is taken up is really a comment about class, about certain kinds of vernacular cultural practices, certain kind of histories that we're alluding to that get recycled again. So some people think of it as minstrelsy. Some people think of it as a certain kind of buffoonishness, right? And as a vehicle for telling stories and as an access point into Hollywood, Perry has done very well because he's understood the way in which the structure of the industry works. He's understood his market. He's understood the kind of sponsorship and the patronage that is required to succeed. And in a way, I think, in a way, it is a history of black enterprise, right, that he's building on. And at the same time, I think that there is a critical community, a long history of critical ways of thinking about these questions that's not new, as Nicole says, for now. And so the ways in which that critical conversation about what's also not there in the space that Perry takes up.
What isn't there?
Well, there's lots of. I mean, mm-hmm. one can go to Broadway. One can go to playwrights. One can mm-hmm. go to the long history of black storytelling that you know, just turn to the internet, turn to YouTube, turn to the various kind of low-budget social media storytelling that plays out there. And there are lots of very local stories that are being told. So one has to ask then, what is this sort of symmetry between the need for a Hollywood machine to have stories of the kind that Perry tells and these other kinds of stories that can't get any traction in that kind of machinery?
The right? other stories, presumably more realistic, more nuanced, more.
It's not, I mean, I think as we suggest, it's not really about real versus not real. It's really a way of trying to tap into this long history of black storytelling. So that black folks have imaginations about the possible and the impossible and science fiction and any other. So I don't think that this is a request for realism so much as it is trying to understand how the very logics of the mediums that we're talking about press constantly towards a kind of oneness, a kind of singularity, and that is as damaging and that is as narrowing, both in terms of a critical conversation as well as in terms of the kinds of productions that we're sort of aiming for. Hollywood still makes film for 16 to 22-year-old white guys, right? And right. if you happen to kind of be in that demographic bracket, and, you know, there is a way in which the kinds of stories that get told are repetitions of the same thing. And so who falls out of that storytelling apparatus? Right, which is not to say that there aren't other stories. It is to say that the apparatus constantly presses towards aiming for that ideal subject. And I think the conversation that we're having is to kind of ask, then what other modes of storytelling are available? What other mediums are available? What other modes of circulation are available to tell those stories?
And I think what Jay's doing is fantastic because Jay is tapping into narrative.
Yeah.
And so when Herman's talking about storytelling, I just think of narrative as, you know, that's within any given society, that's how we make sense of the world around us is through narrative. And if our narratives of blackness are, you know, so familiar that we can say Amos and Andy is in so many ways speak to certain kind of timing scenarios that happen in Tyler Perry, right? I mean, that we can actually look and see the kind of connection. These are the kind of narratives that, like, broadly speaking, we not only just accept, but that somehow we they fulfill something, I think, in a broader cultural imagination around blackness. And it is a kind of story of simplicity, right?
Mm-hmm. Like a formula, maybe.
Yeah, it's a formula, but it's also a notion of thinking in really simplistic terms about the complexity of race making in the U.S. And I think it's hard for us to think about the complexity of that, about race making in this country. Mm-hmm. It's much easier for us to turn black suffering and, you know, the story you're talking about of Antoine Dotson into something that becomes minstrelsy.
Yeah.
Because there's so much complexity that actually was happening in that very moment where he saved his sister, right? Yeah. But we don't want to consider all of that, you know?
Right.
So it's much easier for us to fall back on something that's almost like a laugh track of blackness, right? The kind of, I mean, that, and I think with Phantom, I think what Jay is doing with Phantom is she's playing on what's familiar and what's unfamiliar for us. So what's familiar is the idea of blackness as the spook who sat by the door. Mm-hmm. But but there's mystery and power in that very ability to be the spook, right? And to be seen and unseen.
And to reclaim that rather than just living it at the hands of, you know, white people who, you know, take these tropes and they use it against us.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Toni Morrison learned that she got the Nobel Prize, she said, now we are taking back the narrative, telling our own story. More on Seeing Blackness when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I'm back with guests who are talking about Seeing Blackness. In this part of the show, I'm going to be talking to Herman Gray from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and also to Nicole Fleetwood from Rutgers University. I'd like to talk a little bit about representations of black women in particular, and we can think of sort of large cultural icons like Oprah, like Diana Ross, like Serena Williams, and so on. And, you know, issues of blackness and the concepts of beauty have been a part of this country's legal and political and social history, you know, trying to figure out who thinks of beauty in what ways. Can each of you kind of weigh in on representations of black women and some of the problems in that in the past and some of what you see today? Maybe I'll start with you, Nicole.
So I want to just ask you, are you asking specifically about issues of beauty? I wanted to hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking in particular of the, you know, one of the some of the research behind the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education with the concepts of, you know, which dowels looked better. And then the repetition of some of those studies more recently suggests that still embedded in our culture are concepts of beauty that are very destructive. And in particular, it seems as if girls, sometimes in terms of their concept of hair, concept of features, everything, that there are some images that are problematic.
Yeah, you know, and I think there's a lot of really interesting work done on beauty. I mean, one is a great book by Deborah Willis, who's a MacArthur Genius Award winner and chair of photography at NYU. It's a co-author book that's specifically on black beauty, and it's a just gorgeous photo essay series that I think is worth considering. But one of the things I would like us to think about is just beauty is such a contested notion in culture, broadly speaking, and I think, you know, it's a stranglehold on young girls of all races, this idea of what's beauty, what's feminine, what is attractive and seductive to what audiences. And I don't think these audiences are just like, you know, some kind of fantasy man. A lot of girls doll up or dress up for other women, you know, for their peer group. So I do think that when we think about beauty and race, that it's really important for us to think more complexly. Sometimes I'm concerned when this conversation around blackness and beauty seems to go down a line of argument that black girls don't have a sense of themselves or a sense of beauty. And I think that is absolutely false. You know, I think that there are really complex, celebrated practices and aesthetics of beauty, especially in black vernacular culture, that in some ways are in complete disregard to what mainstream white folks think about black people. I mean, I just think in the streets of Harlem, where I live in Harlem, there's a sense of fashion and adornment and self-possession that I don't see anywhere else in the United States. I've seen it in maybe when I've visited parts of Africa or parts of Brazil. And it really is one that completely marginalizes what's on the cover of Vogue or GQ magazine. That is of little concern within this kind of framework of everyday beauty and everyday kind of sense of glory and adornment that I think is very much about a kind of black survival strategy for hundreds of years that black people have had ways of braiding their hairs, of adorning scarves, of taking tattered clothing and turning it into something that was, you know, quite delightful. And so I just want to say that because I think it really is important to think about another archive and another history and story around beauty in this country, beauty and race. But I think you're asking me also something else. Is it? Yeah.
Well, I know that, you know, your book on racial icons also looks at sort of the portrayal of celebrity women. And I didn't know whether there was sort of special considerations when looking at representations of black women in the media, you know, whether it's on television or in the front of magazines.
Well, I mean, Diana Ross, who's one chapter in the study, I mean, is one of the most photographed people in the 20th century. I mean, her beauty, you know, I don't think of race as ever transcendent, but journalists and fashion critics would talk about her beauty as somehow transcendent. And this is, again, this kind of twinning of veneration and denigration. It was saying there's something about her that is so beautiful that it escapes blackness.
Yeah, which
and that
is, kind of...
yeah, that is truly problematic. But what I love about Diana Ross and you know, women like her is that this kind of this very much kind of cultivation of a notion of beauty was within, you know, black vernacular traditions. I mean, that she said everything she learned about who she is was from this, a woman who was trained in a kind of black beauty school in Detroit. Mm-hmm. That this is a tradition of a kind of racialized sense of aestheticizing the body, the face. I, you know, developed this idea of giving face about her kind of cultivation of face and using, you know, people like Roland Barthes to think about how we can turn the face into a kind of object, a fetish object in, you know, model culture and cinema and just celebrity culture more broadly speaking. But I do think that for me it's really important to claim that and to just sit with it and not to sit with it in relationship to whiteness. That to me is something that occupies its own space and time. And that what Diana Ross was doing was not trying to in any way to be white or feel like she had to compete with standards of whiteness. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She was embracing her own sense of beauty.
You know, I don't have much to add. I think it was well, beautifully put. I mean, beautiful. I do like and sign on to what Nicole called self-possession and self-making, right? That part of the notion of beauty to sort of unsettle and disturb perhaps the way you were thinking about or media might constitute it, is that, you know, what are the spaces in which black self-making happens with or without the gaze of whites? It's sort of beside the point in some ways, right? And, you know, Toni Morrison, I heard in this last interview with her, last round of interviews, when she was talking about her latest novel, she had this phrase, she says, you know, I'm inviting you into my home. And in my home, I set the terms. Whether you like it or not is not the point. You are my guest. And as my guest, then I offer you, right, my home and my place. And I think this notion of beauty that Nicole's articulating reminds me of that, right? That this deep archive of sort of Black understandings of self-making and self-possession is, again, never accessible through the dominant modes of representation.
And how would Serena Williams add, you know, another layer to this discussion? Because she would fall in the category of, you know, stereotypes we might have about athletes, about women, about Blackness. And there she is with her sister, you know, in the news and sort of creating a sense of power and maybe that self-possession that you just mentioned as well. I know you have referred to her as well.
I say this to people all the time. If I could be anyone for one day, it would be Serena Williams because everywhere she goes is she is, you know, winning, you know, and she's fully in possession of herself. But, you know, I think it's humorous. I mean, I can just say it's humorous, is that the conversation in I don't want to say that the Huffington Post and New York Times are just sources of white mainstream media, because I know all kinds of non-whites who read those venues and those outlets. But the conversation that happens often in these spaces around Serena Williams, I think, are really funny and sometimes upsetting and disturbing to a lot of non-white people. And I'm saying Blacks, but I also know a lot of Latinos, a lot of Asian Americans who really claim Serena Williams as this, in some ways, a superhero.
And what is it in the discussion that troubles them or makes them...
That she doesn't measure up to somehow white standards of what a tennis player, female tennis player looks like, or that her beauty is, quote, non-traditional. Mm-hmm. Well, not within the history of there's a song called She's a Brick House, right? It's about someone like a Serena Williams,
Ritchie,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah,
is a sure. really, who's
Lionel Richie and
yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, and so there's a way that kind of embodiment of a very powerful, strong, fully possessed, powerful, gorgeous Black woman is very much a kind of a folk tradition within African American culture. You know, it's not something unusual or out of the ordinary. And I think because the world of white professional tennis is such a small, narrow world that they think that it's the center of the conversation, but actually it's the periphery of a much more interesting conversation. You know,
and
the only way I can describe it is that it's like so beyond white tennis notions of beauty, you know.
And I was thinking about what we were talking about earlier about veneration and denigration, right? That somehow in Serena you actually have this kind of tension exacerbated between those two moments, right? The kind of prideful way in which she's relentless in her victories and her command of her sport, and a kind of, you know, like she's not beautiful in that sense. And you can see them both playing out on her body, right? And I think in that way, she's the perfect example of trying to unsettle the ease with which we think about beauty as finished, as already done. And either you are it or you're not it. And yet here's this figure who comes along and just changes the game, because it raises all these questions about, well, how do we get here? Right? She exposes the history of our thinking about how we got here just by merely being on the scene, right? The thinking about seeing the camera, right? She in some ways refuses the camera's tendency to fix her. Right, she refuses, her literal body refuses the fixity of beauty or denigration or, you know, not good at. I mean, she just really unsettles that in a profoundly, I think, interesting way and beautiful way.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions I have for you both is, what upsets you? What angers you? I mean, you're in this field of looking at images of Blackness, and most of us have something where we have passion about it. And if we could have the whole world listening, we would want to change something. We would want them to know something. So I was going to ask you, Nicole, what gets you incensed? What do you feel passionate about?
I had a conversation recently. I was on a panel at another university, and I was saying, when I wake up in the morning and get out of bed, it's not out of anger. It's out of love. So mm-hmm. I think for me, it's like, I mean, there's, you know, day to day seeing people get mistreated is definitely, you know, something that makes me want to be exacting and vigilant and fearless in calling out what it means to live in an unjust society. But when I'm doing my work, I don't write because I'm incensed. I write because I'm feeling deep affinity for something or someone, and I want to get closer to that person or that thing. I don't write from a space of revulsion.
Mm-hmm. But if you could change something,
what would it be
in terms of how people see blackness? Our topic is seeing blackness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How would you like blackness to be seen differently?
I mean, to me, the seeing blackness is much more is connected to systemic, violent, anti-black racism. And it's not just anti-black racism. I mean, it's class-based oppression. It's, you know, unjust immigration policies and the like. But, you know, we're here talking about seeing blackness. And of course, if I could undo that history and undo that present moment, if I was Phantom and I could, you know, Jay had this really amazing, powerful kind of video from one of her, I think, exhibitions where she gives Eric Garner the power to erase the white man who killed him.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yes. I want Jay to be able to give us all that power. You know,
we'll be talking
it's a
about
very
that
powerful.
A bit,
yeah, it's a very powerful. So if there's something I could, you know, wish away, it would be to wish away whatever it is that leads some people to want to kill other people based on
the color of their skin,
on the color of their skin, who they choose to sleep with, or all kinds of, you know, for all kinds of reasons that make the world less viable for many people.
And Herman, what about you? What are you angry about or passionate about or eager to change in the way people see things?
That's a good question. You know, I was thinking, as Nicole was talking, that there is this kind of global conversation among black people that is a really rich history and a rich conversation, and that this constant turn to find a place for blackness within the kind of racially unjust world, it seems to me, is bereft and impoverished to the extent that those conversations are not part of it. And I mean Caribbean and African and, you know, sub-Saharan African and diasporic Europe and Latin America, right? So the richness of kind of black lives globally is something that I think we suffer from because of our kind of myopic national obsession. And that if we could just widen the scope and sort of understand that, you know, there's this kind of rich circulation of black people. Again, not sameness, not unanimity, but in fact the richness of black difference is a kind of world that I think lots of us are trying to kind of get on the map. And I guess I'm frustrated to the extent that we keep thinking that the moral, ethical goodness of a system organized around economic profit and exploitation is going to yield a kind of more humane, more just representation or way of seeing, and that the profound contradictions between the pursuit of those sorts of ends, profit and efficiency and privatization and personal responsibility as if those things are disconnected from social life, from structures of the allotment of injustice and justice, the allocation of access to risk, health, food, housing, right? That those things are organized in ways that disadvantage some people and advantage other people. And that in that context, to continue to expect an image culture, a way of seeing, to simply modify its practice, it seems to me, right, to sort of keep asking a set of impossible questions within a narrow context, which is why I was thinking about this more globally and thinking about this in a different sort of context. So I guess my passion is to sort of really think about the other modes of telling, the other modes of imagining, sonic, musical, theatrical, artistic, visually, that enliven black life, right? Assert a certain kind of black self-making and a certain kind of black self-possession that has a much longer history than one that's simply rooted in black suffering and black deprivation.
And we're going to look at one artist who is imagining different possibilities when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking about seeing blackness. And at this point in the conversation, I am going to turn to my third guest, Jay Katalinsky. She is a University of Wisconsin-Madison MFA student and a practicing artist whose work plays with images of blackness and how they shift the narrative. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Jay, before we turn to your own work, is this Twitter campaign, If They Gun Me Down. Can you talk about that and how images play a role there?
Yeah, so that whole Twitter social media phenomenon was, you know, posting pictures as which the media would choose, you know, if they were killed. And, you know, always when we see images of black people who have been murdered at the hands of police or at the hands of others who, you know, were unarmed, and the reason why they were murdered was solely because of their body and the fact that they were black. You know, they still choose to choose these images of black folks as, you know, as menaces or as thugs or, you know, to make people be fearful of them and make some justification as to why, you know, they were violated. And I think it's really important that, you know, that Twitter or, you know, as they call it, Black Twitter, you know, took over and was, you know, put, you know, the two images, the images of how they are, but how media would represent them and how different they are. And just to think of like that separation, that how easy it is for the media to make someone out to be who they're not. And I, you know, I try to think about that in my work a lot and how to change that and how to make it so that blackness isn't monolithic to people, that it's, you know, it's vast and it's amorphous and, you know, it's ever changing.
It is amazing how influential an image can be in a news story, because if you have a news story about a black teen gunned down, and if the image shown makes them look like you said, like a thug, as opposed to showing them in cap and gown as an honor student, it totally shapes how someone responds to the situation. You know, so if you take the same person and you show them in a, you know, in a suit and tie, if you show them in a cap and gown, if you show them dressed as a surgeon, you know, the way that we portray someone with one image only can make a difference. In your work, how do you sort of use current events, like the events, you know, here in Madison or elsewhere in the country, how do you take that current event and sort of do something with it?
So when I first started making my work, like I said earlier, it stemmed from the Trayvon Martin murder. And I started making these screen prints of Trayvon Martin as the one picture that they had of him smiling, the only one that, you know, that was circulated. And I had printed it in black glitter, so it shined. And it was, for me, it was this moment to be like, he was just a kid. He was just a boy. There was still innocence in him. He still glittered, and this was taken away. And that was, you know, that was the first moment of that, to try to change the way that people, you know, were seeing them. And because printmaking is this thing in which that you could, it's, you know, you can make multiples, and you can make them quick, and you can make them fast. And that's what I was doing. I was trying to keep making all these images to post around the city so people could see this and remember that this is the image, you know. And, you know, the problem is the fact that you have to validate someone's existence. You have to, you know, it'd be like, they were a good kid, they didn't deserve this, or they were, you know, college bound and what have you. You know, with Tony Robinson, you know, they kept mentioning, you know, that he was going to college. He had graduated. And it was the fact that we have to validate this, which is problematic.
What are some of the other ways that you would look at words, phrases, you know, ways of talking about situations and sort of make that into your art?
Yeah, so one of the pieces that I did for my my MA qualifier show last year, it was a tape text piece, so it's with, you know, white tape on the wall, that's a white wall. And it said, it's a quote from Claudia Rankine that she did in an interview in an art forum, I believe. And she said, she posed the question, you know, what is the solution for constantly being watched when no one sees us at all, you know, when no one sees you at all? And so under, you know, so the, it was white tape on white wall, so it was hard to see. You could still see it, but you had to, you know, you had to get up close. You had to really look at it. And underneath the tape text piece, I had portraits that I've taken with instant film, like a Fuji Instax film Polaroid, of black men on campus. And I laid them on the floor. There was 23 images. So you had to crouch down and look. You had to acknowledge these black men who you may see on a normal day basis every single day, but you don't acknowledge them. And some of them are smiling. Some of them, you know, are stoic. And it made the viewers engage. It made, these are people, you know, they matter, and you should treat them as such.
The idea of white tape on white wall kind of reminds me of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man,
yes,
where he's got all the light bulbs on, but nobody sees him.
Yes. You know? So, it's funny because I didn't read Invisible Man until recently. So after making this work, once someone presented it to me, I knew that I couldn't read it while I was working on my MA show, because I knew it would shift everything that I was already thinking about. But yeah, I mean, there's a part in his book where he talks about that he's walking on the street and he's bumped. And he, you know, at first he tries to, you know, think about how maybe, you know, the guy was in a dream state, but then he talks about how, but the guy is in control of his dream state. So regardless, he chose not to see you. Mm-hmm. He chose not to see him. And, you know, that happens on a daily basis sometimes here on campus, you know, where people choose not to see you.
And you said that you use this concept of a phantom.
Yes.
Explain.
So phantom is, you know, the easiest way that I could speak about the things that were happening, because, you know, some of these things don't make sense, and I was trying to make sense of them. So I had to create, you know, a figure that does exist, but also that is mythic and magical, that, you know, plays in these, you know, plays in the, you know, these environments, and, you know, are part of events like Ferguson or what happened here last year on Willie Street, you know, things that don't quite make sense. Why was, you know, an 18-year-old shot in his own home, you know, things that don't quite make sense. That's where I bring phantom in to, you know, they don't fully change the narrative, because I still want to talk about, you know, it's not a whole, like a utopic society where, you know, the violence doesn't happen to black bodies. And I want to, you know, not erase that violence, but give myself some agency to not be overwhelmed with all the things that are happening. So phantom comes in and is, you know, does their magic sometimes. We don't necessarily know why phantom is doing what they're doing, but, you know, some people hope that it's for the greater good, and some people see phantom as a villain. It leaves it very open, because, you know, that's what people, you know, people are, you know,
some people see people as good, certain people, and then some people see the same people as bad. And, you know, that's all, you know, that's all fair.
I want to thank the three guests that have been with me for this hour of University of the Air. We've been talking to Herman Gray, Nicole Fleetwood, and Jay Katalinsky about Seeing Blackness. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Air.